I spoke a little bit about, with some of you about Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson. Rabbeinu Tam was Yocheved's son. Yocheved is one of Rashi's daughters, which is close to Dorian. And he was obviously the greatest Baal HaTosfos. He was called Rabbeinu Tam because his name was Yaakov Yaakov Ishtam. Just as an interesting footnote, he really lived the Crusades on his body. And I say this because this is the period of the Crusades. The Crusades would typically be launched in the spring, around Iyar time and Sivan time. So right around now, and in particular on Shavuos, are the times in which the Crusades came through town and punished the Jews and persecuted. So, for example, in 1096, on Shavuos, was when I think Magenza or Spires was attacked. 1146, remember, this is a great period of the Crusades. The Crusades come into the Rabbeinu Tam's French town. They take him out into the field, and they make five holes in his body, one for each hole that Jesus was crucified with in revenge, and they're about to kill him, and then some Jew comes by, a wealthy Jew, and he bribes the crusaders and rescues Rabbeinu Tam. And then 1171, about 30 years later, there's another crusade right around now, and that establishes Chaf Sivan. The 20th of Sivan became a fast day with Slichos for hundreds of years. If you go back 200-300 years in history, even 100 years in history, everyone fasted on Chaf Sivan, and Rabbeinu Tam made that takana. So you've heard a lot about Rabbeinu Tam, and he makes Torah in France. He creates Torah in France. There was no Torah in France when Rashi was growing up. He had to go to Germany to study Torah. And the two shittos of Rabbeinu Tam that are the most familiar to most people, even though we don't conventionally paskin like them, is one, of course, a sheet about Banish Mashos, Tzeitzer Kochavim. We paskin like the Vilna Gaon. But until the Vilna Gaon came, many people held like Rabbeinu Tam, but the Vilna Gaon restored his position. The second sheet that's familiar to many people is Tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. And especially since a lot of you won't be here for Tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, first of all, I just want you to know what they are before I talk about the Machshava. And then I want to share with you how the Rav tried to explain it in two different ways. They're a little bit related, but I'll say them as different. You'll be able to connect the two. Okay, the Gemara says in Menachos, the first source, Ketzat Sidron, how should you place the tefillin? Let's assume we're talking about tefillin Shalosh now, where there are separate parchments, so you can actually decide what to place where. Ketzat Sidron, Kadesh, V'hayaki V'acha, Shema, V'hayem Shema. Four parshios in tefillin, two sections in the end of bow, Kadesh li kol Bechar, V'hayaki V'acha Shem Elokecha, that's Hashem. Second parsha, third parsha Shema Yisrael, fourth parsha Ekev V'Hayim Shema. So the Brisa says, basically you should write them in the order they appear in the Torah, which is the logical way. I mean, that's how they appear. So that's how you should insert them into the tefillin. The Gemara quotes a Brisa that suggests the opposite, that they go in the opposite direction. So the Gemara says, Lo kasha, kan mimino shokari, kan mimino shomenech. Depends how you're looking at them. If you're looking at them as you are, like make believe the blackboard is someone wearing tefillin. If you're looking at them the way you're an outsider would look at them, Rashi is on the right, Kadesh, Vayiki V'acha, Shema V'Hayim Shema. The Brisa says they're the opposite, is listing them in the sequence that a person wearing them would feel. So a person wearing them would feel, would say V'Hayim Shema, because you're starting from the right, because that's how Hebrew starts. So if you're looking at it starting from the right, if you're thinking about it while it's on your head, starting from the right would be the opposite, inverted, and that's the Brisa. So according to Rashi, that's how we get to those tefillin. The Rabbeinu Tam has a whole different sequence, without getting to how he reads the Gemara right now, but his sequence is the third source, and for Rabbeinu Tam, here's the Makor, Kadesh Vayiki V'acha Mimin Shel Karei. So again, you're looking at tefillin, you're the Karei, you're the one looking at someone wearing tefillin, reading them, or imagining where the parshas are. So someone looking at the blackboard wearing tefillin, Shema V'Hayim Shema, Kadesh Vayiki V'acha Mimin Shel Karei. And then you have a second unit, Shema V'Hayim Shema, Mimin Shel Miniach, with Shema beginning. So essentially, Shema's on the outside. So Shema V'Hayim Shema become inverted. So what's clear about the Rabbeinu Tam is it doesn't follow the sequence of the Torah. The question is why? This is a very, very famous question. Why does Rabbeinu Tam follow the sequence of the Torah? The answer is, and it's latent in the Rabbeinu Tam statement, and it's latent in the Gemara, so Rabbeinu Tam essentially divides tefillin into two separate subunits of two. We think of the four parshas of tefillin as one set of four, one sequence. According to Rabbeinu Tam, there are two sequences of two. One sequence, just to look at the board, is Kadesh Raikiyavyacha. That's one sequence from the right of the person looking at it. The other sequence is Shema V'Hayim Shema from the right of the person wearing it. So essentially, the order of the Torah is maintained, but you just divide them into two different units, and each unit corresponds to a different perspective. So from the perspective of the looker, he's looking at the first, or the spectator, he's looking at the first two parshios in order. And then from the perspective of the wearer, he's looking at the second two parshios in their order. So everything's sequential, but you subdivide, basically the two assumptions of Rabbeinu Tam, you subdivide into two groups, and each group corresponds to a different perspective. One to the perspective of the spectator, one to the perspective of the wearer. Question is, why? What does this mean? So the Rav developed two ideas, and they're both written in Rav Kahn's book, and you can read them, but I just wanted to let you get a sense of it. He quoted a beautiful medrash. The medrash says, source number four, is that enumerated, Yihi libi tamim b'chukecha. You should always follow Hashem's chukim. What's a chok? So we typically assume that a chok is something irrational. As I've told you before, and Rav Soloveitchik talked about this as well, a chok is not just something irrational, it's also something foundational, something that can't change. It's the baseline, it's the constitution, it's the basics, it's the fundamental. And the Rav claimed, having nothing to do with tefillin, that those two meanings of chok are essentially complementary. How does something become unchanging and permanent if it isn't subjected to time, culture, changes, or human logic? So Hashem says something, it can become a chok because it shouldn't change no matter where you live, how you live, what generation, nor should you analyze and try to understand it. You just keep it blindly and unconditionally. Those are two separate statements. We typically say them together. Blindly means you don't apply logic to it. Unconditionally means it just lasts forever, even though times may change and it may seem odd and it may seem different. So a chok is something unchanging, foundational, and it isn't subject to human ration or human analysis. So the Medrash says there are two times the Torah uses the word zos chukas. One is zos chukas ha-pesach, the Korban Pesach. One is zos chukas ha-adam, zos chukas ha-Torah in Parshas Chukas, which we'll read soon, about Paraduma. The Medrash says, which is more important, chukas ha-pesach or chukas Paraduma? So the Medrash says, well, it's like looking at two women walking. You want to know which woman is more important? See which woman escorts the other woman home. So let's say one woman lives on block A and one woman lives on block B, and the woman of block B escorts the woman to block A home and then goes to her home, then the woman of block A is more important because block B woman escorted her. So if you want to know which chok is more important, look at who escorts whom. And the answer is that Korban Pesach, Kacha Pesach Nano Para, Chuka Para, Migidola Hapara, Shaokli Pesach Tzrichim La. Namely, people who eat Pesach need a paraduma. You can't be tame, you can't eat Pesach if you're tame, so you need a paraduma. So, figuratively, if you're walking to Korban Pesach, you have to make a stop at the house of paraduma. Because you can't get to your house at Korban Pesach until you stop off at paraduma, until you escort paraduma to her home, and then process paraduma, become tar, then you can eat Korban Pesach. This is, of course, a mystifying medrash. These midrashim are very, very provocative, and this is where the Rav stepped in. Basically, Jews experience two unchanging, irrational phenomena. One is ritual, mitzvahs that we just don't understand, chazir, paraduma, shatnez. But then there's another experience that we have to undergo that's irrational and unchanging, and that's historical irrationality. Right? That whatever we do, we're persecuted, we're despised. Now that we have a country, we're exposed to this. That the arc of Jewish history isn't like most national arcs. The Jewish history follows its own arc, and it's not something you can understand logically. It's not something you could try to analyze. It's not something you can make sense of. And I've told you this before. I just spoke about this yesterday in Hong Kong, literally a couple hours ago. We're fatalists, but just because we're fatalists doesn't mean that we forfeit opportunity. Namely, I don't think that anti-Semitism can be eliminated. It's built into history. We challenge the world. Because we challenge the world, they dislike us. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try our hardest to limit it and to try to uproot it and to try to battle it and to try to create harmony. Same thing in Israel. Do I think there's some magic solution, a magic peace plan? No. But I think that we can limit bloodshed and suffering and try to, if we can, try our hardest, whatever is possible. So I know some of you are going back to college campuses, and you'll be involved in political activism on behalf of Israel. I think it's supremely important. But don't enter it naively as if, oh, if we just get our ducks in a row and shout loud enough and explain it long enough. It's something built into history because of our role. Geri Yezer Acha Beretz Lolam. But it doesn't mean that we hate people or that we give up hope for people. So Jews have to endure these two chukos. One chok, irrational and unchanging, is ritual that we don't always understand. One chok, irrational and unconditional and unchanging, is history. Pesach relates to the historical chok, because Pesach is when we lived history and entered history. Paraduma is ritual. There's nothing historical about Paraduma. So that's the ritual chok. So when the Torah uses the chok for Pesach and the chok for Paraduma, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Torah is telling us you'll have to go through two different experiences that are fundamental, unchanging, and irrational. Now the question is, and this is a question which I think is very provocative, which comes first? Which is more basic? Does the first and person have to buy in to the irrational ritual part and then ascend and live Jewish history, even though it's challenging? Or does it start from history, and then once you buy into Jewish history and you live Jewish history like Rus, even though it's changing, it's hard, it's challenging, then you get to ritual? That's a very interesting question. I think if you ask Rav Cook that question, he may have a different answer than the Rav. When I read this piece, I was reading it on the plane last night, I was thinking, what would I say? But the Rav said something very clear. For the Rav, the ritual comes before the collective and the historical. And he has a whole psychoanalysis of why, because basically a person has bestial needs and urges and impulses, and those have to be curbed by mitzvahs and have to be channeled by mitzvahs. So first a person has to buy in to the personal, ritual, religious experience that's irrational and foundational. And then you can join. And for the Rav, that's what this Medrash is saying. Medrash is saying, what's more important? The Chok of Pesach, the historical experience that's irrational, or the Chok of Paraduma, which is the ritual experience? And the Medrash says, well, take a look. Everyone who eats Pesach has to first go through Paraduma. So everyone who wants to get to that Pesach frequency, where you're living Jewish history despite its challenge, you have to first go through the Paraduma. What does this have to do with Tefillin? It's a nice Medrash. What does this have to do with Tefillin? For the Rav, this is what the duality of Rav Eitan's Tefillin suggested. Remember, according to Rashi, the Tefillin is one sequence of four units. According to Rav Eitan, it's two different sequences. So essentially, you've got a duality in Tefillin. And what's the duality? The first two parshios are history. They become before Matan Torah. There's no mitzvos yet. And they each mention Karban Pesach, the Chukas of Pesach. So I quoted the Pesukim for you on the bottom. Vayali also Yadcha l'skarben enecha, ki b'yad chazak otziach Hashem mitzvayim. And the second parsha is, ki b'chazak yad otziach Hashem mitzvayim. Shema does not mention Pesach. Shema mentions mitzvos. So essentially, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, according to Rabbi Natam, you've got these two different dynamics at work in Tefillin. And one is ordered from the left, and one is ordered from the right. And here's the punchline, at least this punchline, which comes first? Shema v'ayim shemar, because that's the ritual. And of course, first means right to left from the wearer, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik. So if I'm asking, of these four parshios, which is subdivided into two units, which of these two units comes first? It's the Shema and the Hayim Shema, which is the ritual of mitzvahs, which start from the right of the person wearing them. So that's how we can explain Rabbi Natam, subdividing Tefillin into two units of two. Each unit has a different theme. Those themes reflect different components of religious consciousness. But the first one is Shema and Hayim Shema, which starts from the right of the wearer, and then he thinks about Kadosh Ve'ekiviach. Okay, interesting. On a very, very similar note, but even more intriguing, the Rav talked about the two shins. Did you ever notice that your tefillin has two shins? The shin on the left of the wearer and the shin on the right. So this comes from a Tosfos. If you take a look at Tosfos, in the middle of the page, he quotes a sefer, a Rishonim sefer about Stam called Shimusha Rabba. One of the Rishonim wrote a sefer about how to write tefillin. And so Shimusha Rabba says tefillin Sura de Shin Diamina Gimel Reshe Vidismola Dalad Reshe. Typically that means that the shin on the left of the tefillin from your perspective is a three-legged or three-armed shin, and the tefillin on your right is a four-armed shin. Now the big question is, Who ever saw a forearm shin? What does a forearm shin mean? Why is it there? So the answer to this is provided by the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef says that the forearm shin on the right of your tefillin is meant to reflect a different font. Which font? The font of the Luchos. Now the font of the Luchos wasn't different in its shape, but it was different in its construction because it was engraved. Okay, so the letters were not material, but the letters of the Luchos were the absence of material. You had the surface level of the stone, and the letters were not, typically when we think of letters, we put ink or some substance on a piece of parchment, and that reflects the letters. But when you engrave on Luchos, letters are essentially not substance, but air, the absence of substance. You've taken it away. Now, we don't want to engrave our tefillin, because that would be destructive to the tefillin. So to recreate the ksav of the Luchos, we have four, look at my hands, we have four arms. If you look at not the material, but the space, how many arms to the shin are there when you have four arms?
Three.
There are three spaces. So the real shin on the right of your tefillin is a three-leg, is a three-arm shin. But it's a three-arm shin that mimics the three-arm shin of the Luchos. So the left shin, again from your perspective, is the shin of a Sefer Torah, parchment upon material. So it's the three arms that are material. And the shin on your right, when you're wearing it, is the forearm shin, which is really creating a three-arm shin if you look at the spaces, which is what the writing on the Luchos was. That's all in the Beis Yosef. But now the question is, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, why are we trying to create different types of shins? What's the difference between the shin of the Sefer Torah and the shin of the Luchos? You see how this Rabbeinu Tam changes your whole perspective on tefillin because it's not four, it's two separate units. That's the whole theme. The thesis of the Rabbeinu Tam is you're dealing with two times two, not four. And more or less Rabbi Soloveitchik said as well that, let me give you a little bit of background. In Yisrael Mishpatim, there's a lot of Har Sinai happening. Moshe gets the Luchos and Rachei Shem Elokecha. Hashem tells him, come to Shemayim. And then at the end of Mishpatim, they make a covenant. In a very, very general sense, Rashi feels it's all overlapping. It's all the same story being told from different vantage points. The Ramban says, listen carefully, it's a good Shavuos idea. The Ramban says, no, there's a sequence here. At Har Sinai on Vav Sivan, Hashem delivers the Luchos to Moshe and the event of Matan Torah occurs. The next day, Moshe goes up to Shemayim for 40 days and comes down with the rest of the Torah. The Jews didn't receive the entire Torah in Vav Sivan. They received 10 mitzvahs, 10 commandments. The rest of the Torah was taught to Moshe for 40 days, and then he descends and conducts a covenant with the Jewish people in the end of Mishpatim about all the mitzvahs. Essentially then, you've got two different types of Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim. You've got Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim at Har Sinai, pre-mitzvahs, when there's really only a smattering of mitzvahs. But what's that based upon? Yitzias Mitzrayim. Because of Yitzias Mitzrayim, because of Tikkus HaMibes Avodim. And then you've got another Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim, 40 days later, based on Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. The first one is centered upon the Luchos, on Vav Sivan. The second one is centered upon an actual Sefer Torah, which Moshe delivers 40 days later. So you've got these two different forms of Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim, each with their respective icons. The icon of the first Malchus Shemayim is the Luchos. The icon of the second Malchus Shemayim is the Torah. The icon, the content of the first Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim is the Tzias Mitzrayim. The icon or the content of the second Malchus Shemayim is mitzvahs. So according to Rabbeinu Tam, that's what we do. Essentially, on the right, from the wearer's perspective, we're going to add a little bit of a change, so listen carefully. On the right, from the wearer's perspective, you've got the The opposite. The four-arm shin is on the left. The three-arm shin is on the right. I apologize. So, on the right, from the wearer's perspective, you've got Shema V'Hayim Shema, in order, starting from the right. And that's Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim and Mitzvos. And that shin is the Sefer Torah shin, a regular three-arm shin. And on the left, you've got the other Kabbalas Malchus Shemayim with the shin of the Luchos focused on Yitzias Mitzrayim, Nach Hashem Elokecha, and here's the additive, that is right to left from the perspective of the reader. Because Kabbalah's Malchus Shemayim and Yitzias Mitzrayim is something I have to broadcast to other people. Kabbalah's Malchus Shemayim for Mitzvot is something I keep to myself. So, hopefully I'm becoming the blackboard and you're looking at me. When I'm a Kabbalah, everything goes right to left. So my Kabbalah's Malchus Shemayim, based on Mitzvot, is Shema V'Hayim Shemoah, with the regular Shin, because that's the Sefer Torah, that's the laws of Mitzvot. But I have a responsibility to teach you and the entire world about Yitzias Mitzrayim, because that's Hashem's Hashkacha. So it has the Shin of the Luchos, and its order is not right to left for me, but right to left for you. So when you're reading it, you're reading the sequence about Yitzias Mitzrayim with the Luchos Shin and Akabal's Malchus Shemayim. So it's fascinating to see how the Rav made sense of Rabbeinu Tam, because otherwise it just seems baffling. Rashi seems like the correct order. You divide them in two. Either it's a duality based on two different types of irrational experiences, or two different types of Kabbalah Zatara, Kabbalah Malchus Shemayim. There's a lot of overlap between the two. But what's really fascinating is the two shins. When I first heard that, I learned this about 25 years ago the first time. I was just blown away. This shin is the shin of the Luchos, because it's Kabbalah Malchus Shemayim and Yitzias Mitzrayim. At the point the Luchos were given, that's all they had, more or less. This shin is the shin of Sefer Torah, the three-arm shin, because now they have the rest of the Torah. This part is for you, so it's right to left for you. This part you try to broadcast to other people, so it's not right to left for you in order, it's right to left for the person reading it in the order of the Torah. Okay? Go ahead. Sorry about the voice.